science was a relatively new term that came into existence in the 1700s by a British writer, William Whewell. But they used to call it natural philosophy because it was assumed it was just going to be one of the handmaidens that was supporting the chief mistress, which was theology. We no longer live in that time. Our time now, science is now the chief social status. Even the jokes are about science, like, well, he's no rocket scientist, but, but it's like rocket scientists, any kind of scientist has this elevated status that in the Middle Ages was for theology. We can't turn the clock back on that. Not possible. But we have the tools in Christianity to speak the language of science, to engage science. Doesn't mean we all have to be scientists. I'm not. But we can study it, we can get good at it, and we can get good enough so that faith and reason can work together, as in John Paul II's great encyclical, Fides et Ratio, Faith and Reason was the name of it, and he called upon us to do the very sort of thing we're doing tonight once again. So I thought we would start with that in mind. Let's start with a review of what we did last week. And that is, first of all, the history of the relationship. And let's make tonight a little bit more, less formal. Now, last week I was lecturing a lot, but feel free to ask questions anytime we go, as we proceed through the material tonight. So, what was it about that history? Was there anything surprising about the history and the PowerPoint that I showed last week? Was there anything that you remember from that?
Many of the scientists were philosophers or theologians or religious.
Virtually all of them, thank you. Yeah, that's the point, is that as early as the 1100s, it wasn't just that the church was allowing science. It was that the chief scientists, the natural philosophers, were cardinals and bishops and priests. And remember that Copernicus first came up with his heliocentric theory that the Earth revolves around the Sun and not vice versa in response to a letter from the Pope who asked Catholic scientists and mathematicians to work on the problem astronomically so we could get an accurate dating of Easter. I was trying to completely destroy the myth that the church has always been at war with science. This is big time fake news, bad story that's out there. It's simply not true. There, like in any relationships, there are bumps that have taken place, and we talked briefly about Galileo last time as well. So it hasn't been a perfect relationship. But the church has recognized its problems in that relationship, especially with Galileo. Then remember, we did four models of interaction last week. Anybody remember any of the models? Just shout one out if you remember it from last week.
Communication.
Communication was about the word. That's good. But that we were on about that. But that's not one of the models. What's that?
Conflict.
Yeah, conflict. That's the Time Magazine one. And conflict does come up. And we also said last week that two causes of conflict, one from the religious side and one from the more philosophic side, and that's naturalism. Remember we talked about naturalism? We talked about if you are a biblical fundamentalist, a literalist about the Bible, which is actually quite impossible to do, but it's done by millions, then you're going to have a conflict with contemporary science. So those are two ways of producing the conflict, neither of which is necessary. Naturalism is not a very good philosophy, and biblical literalism has problems that we can talk about at some other point. And do you remember Logos? Mm-hmm. All right, what was the point about logos? Anybody just got one anything that they remember about logos? Where does it occur?
John 1:1.
Bravo. Thank you, sir. Yes, John 1:1, the opening of the Gospel of John. If we read it in English as, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But the original Greek was, in the beginning was the Logos. And the Logos was with God, and the Logos was God. And does anybody remember what Logos meant? Well, it meant about four different things, but the one that's particularly apropos for what we're doing here.
Reason,
yes, good. It's reason. So, logos is the basis of science. If there's going to be a basis, a foundation of science, it's given in the Gospel of John, which is, it's the reason that there is reason. Otherwise, you just say, well, why is there reason? Why do things work? In fact, there was a famous physicist, Eugene Wigner. And Wigner won the Nobel Prize for his work in mathematical physics, which we'll, some of which we're going to do tonight, just without the math. And Wigner said, he wrote an article in which he actually was a believer, and he wrote an article where he talked about the, quote, unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, end quote, in the physical world. He said, why does it work? We do the math, and then we go out and apply it in all different kinds of technology and engineering and so forth. Why are we going to fly to the moon? Why does the math work? Why is there this relationship between the math that we figure out and the actual physical world? And then Albert Einstein said something very similar. He said, the only incomprehensible thing in the universe is that the universe is comprehensible. And that's really what Logos is pointing to. It's saying, wait a minute, why does it work? Why does life make sense? Why are there repeatable, understandable patterns? Now, if you just had something happen one time and it looked really good and it worked, that would be one thing. But the very basis of science is repeatability. But why is it repeatable? And you have a one-word answer to that that I hope you'll keep saying. Say it, you know, like in the shower, you know, in the morning. And that's logos. You just got to keep, start seeing the logos of why a wall stands when it's built at 90 degrees. Why there's light from something like the sun. Everything that makes sense because of this logos. All right, so that's a quick review of where we were last week. Let's move on to our current topic for tonight, which is the origin of the universe from a scientific point of view, which will fit very, very nicely with the origin from the biblical and theological point of view. Well, first, that science conceives a beginning is terribly important. Scientists, when they first came up with the Big Bang, they were horrified. There were so many scientists, many Nobel laureates, who were saying, this can't be true. Because if they understood right away that a beginning of the universe means, well, somebody had to begin it. You don't just get nothing, and then all of a sudden you get something. Now, we call that creatio ex nihilo in theology, creation out of nothing. But you don't get that. But that's what they got, and they hated it. There were like 10 or 15 famous scientists who published things that said, this can't be, when Big Bang Theory first came up. But that's where we're going. So let's look at some of the history of Big Bang and how we got there. But first, let me just tell you just, that could have been a bad thing. Yep, that was a bad thing. Okay, so 150 years for sure, but even in the early 1900s, no one knew how the universe began. There were just a couple theories, but astronomy was in its infancy. People thought that the universe was probably eternal. That's what the scientists typically thought. Now, way, way, way back in the ancient Greek time, people also believed that the universe was eternal, and they called it the eternal world. World and universe were similar terms in the Greek. So if you want to be an atheist, you need an eternal world. Because if it always existed, then you don't need a creator. It just existed. Plato actually had a doctrine of creation, but he had it combined with an eternal world. So the creator wasn't completely responsible for everything that was, because, you know, there was this stuff that was there, and he worked it as best he could. That's in a late work called the Timaeus. But along comes the Jewish understanding of in Genesis, and then the Christians, which just took the entire Old Testament lock, stock, and barrel, as you know. And now all of a sudden, you've got this notion that God created everything. Well, that puts a tremendous responsibility on God, including a responsibility for answering why there's bad stuff in the world then, which we'll do in one of our later sessions, by the way, in association with evolution. But it said the Christian concept was that there was a beginning. It was the Judeo-Christian concept said there was a beginning. And this rocked the first, second, and third centuries as this idea confronted those ancient Greek ideas. Well, when you jump forward to the 1900s in our era, they didn't know. Einstein didn't know. And Einstein thought the world was eternal, the universe was eternal, and he didn't want there to be a beginning. And when Father Georges Lemaître, the fellow who first conceived the Big Bang Theory, told Einstein, well, your own equations, when they're applied, they imply what was called an expanding universe. And that's where we're going in just a moment, because an expanding universe had to expand from something. So that an expanding universe implied a universe with a beginning. All of this starts happening around second century of the early 1900s. So let's move it on. This is a picture, and the picture is necessarily distorted. You can't picture the Big Bang, and you can't picture exactly what happened afterwards. But you could, let's see, you could, if you look at the very beginning, there's like a point, but that's already semi-fictional. But you do have this opening, and then in the first, in the tiniest fraction of a second, you have 10 to the minus 43rd, that's called Planck time. It's the smallest conceivable amount of time. Beneath that, time has no meaning. So then you have what's called inflation, then you have the cosmic microwave background radiation, and eventually you get galaxies, and then you get us guys. So these are the questions. Let's move on to how the Big Bang was formed. You see, Einstein's general relativity was published in 1916, and people started working on these equations. There were a set of equations, and Georges Lemaître was one, and there was a Russian named Alexander Friedman who was another. The theory of Big Bang takes off with this magnificent man you see sitting in that giant telescope there. That's Edwin Hubble, really great American from the 1920s. just was all kinds of wonderful, had amazing biography. But Hubble worked with a former wagon wheel repairman, a guy named Humason. And Humason was really good at the little fix-it stuff. And the two of them were really good team together. And night after night, using this largest telescope in the world at the time, they recorded movements and indicators from the night sky. And this led Hubble to some very unexpected theory. And the first big step in forming the Big Bang theory, apart from Einstein. Okay, so here's Lemaître again on the left. And on the right, that's the iconic Alfred Einstein. But this fellow on the left, Georges Lemaître, it really deserves about as much credit as Einstein in all of this. He was the genius who worked it all out. And you'll notice, once again, it's a Catholic priest. This is not conflict. This is cooperation between science and faith. All right, so Lemaître told Einstein, there's got to be an expansion. And what the guy who proved that there was an expansion was Hubble. Hubble saw that everywhere he looked, that there was what's called redshifted light, which I'll show you a picture of in just a moment. When light shifts to the red, it means that the object that's shining towards you is moving away from you. Everywhere Hubble looked in the whole universe, the light was shifting to the red, except very close. I'll explain this in more detail in just a moment. But that was a shock, that everything in the universe is moving away from everything else in the universe. That's actually what's going on. Now, wrap your mind around that for a few seconds. Wherever we are, everything else is moving away. The whole universe is expanding. It's physically expanding. Now, if it's expanding, what's it expanding from? That's the question that's going to launch Lemaître's theory of Big Bang. All right, well, let's go to a new part of his theory, and that is that there was an original hot explosion, extremely hot, hotter than the mind can imagine explosion. That's the Big Bang. And in fact, Big Bang was originally a term of abuse. People were making fun of the theory, like, ooh, Big Bang, boom, boom, boom. But it stuck. It's a great name. It was a Big Bang. Now, it is best described as an explosion. However, it's not the same as a normal explosion. In a normal explosion, objects fly apart. When you blow something up, they fly apart. But in the Big Bang, you see this lecture hall there. Just picture in your mind a massive sports arena where you're sitting in the seat, like where you're sitting now, and then she's sitting 2 feet away, and then picture somebody who's sitting 200 feet away, way on the other side of the basketball court or wherever you are. All right, now what happens in the Big Bang is there's nothing that's being blown up. Space itself is being stretched. So all of a sudden, let's say we double, remember everything's flying away from everything else. Okay, so let's say we double the volume of space. You're now, instead of 2 feet away from her, you're 4 feet away. But that person that you were 200 feet away from, you're now 400 feet away from. And that's what happened in the Big Bang. The Big Bang stretched the fabric of reality. That's the explosion. Now, that's not a normal explosion. Explosion is the best word we've got. But, again, you have to qualify it. Expansion implies beginning. Yes.
You said earlier that where is it expanding from? The question also is, where is it expanding to? And that answers the question. There needed to be additional space for it to expand into. So the expansion of the space is in and of itself a creative act. Creation of space and then the expansion of that space, because there wasn't space before. There was nothing.
Exactly. Thank you. And that's part of the surprising aspect of Big Bang Theory. When you think of the creation, think about, well, God created stuff. God created things, matter. Everybody thinks God created matter. But in fact, in the Big Bang is the origin of matter, energy, time, and space. Some of you are rightly looking at me like, what do you mean, the origin of time? Yeah, there was no time before the Big Bang, but we'll get into that in just a moment. So thanks for making that point. It's actually all of that comes into existence at the moment of the Big Bang, which is sometimes called T equals zero. Well, we'll get to that in just a moment. So we've got the Hubble expansion. Everything is expanding. That's documented by the astronomical evidence. But if you rewind the expansion over time, just rewind space and rewind time, you rewind and you rewind and you rewind, well, you get to a point where there's no more space to rewind. And you get to a point where you're going back in time, there's no more time. That's the point that they call T equals zero. That's the point of the Big Bang. And it turns out that happened about 13.8 billion years ago. The universe had a birthday, which is very good news theologically, by the way. I mean, that fits Genesis, and it fits John very, very, very nicely. But notice that space and time are intertwined. That's why they sometimes are referred to now as space-time. That's all part of Einstein's theory. Space is not nothing. That's one of the things you got to wrap your mind around. Space is not nothing. Space is not empty. And that's part of the new theory that is confirmed by just about everyone in the field. Okay. So there's your old conception, creation of matter, and there's your new conception, matter, energy, space, and time all come into existence together. Interestingly enough, St. Augustine, way back around about 400 or so, you know that. Go ahead.
No, I don't know the details, but my nephew asked me one time about the beginning, and so I looked up things, and I found St. Augustine and said,
yeah, well, he wrote a whole beautiful book commenting on Genesis, but he said that time begins at creation. There is no time before creation, and it turns out that's right, that the physicists actually agree with that now. So if you say, what happened before the Big Bang? you're shaking your head. And the answer is, you can't even ask that question. There was no before. Oh, yeah, it's got to be before. No, there's got to be before for us guys, because we're always thinking about before, during, and after. But there was no before. So this is one of those magnificent physics theories that makes you just pause and go, whoa, something mystical, wonderful happening, which is what we should be doing anyway. Every time we think about even the biblical text or what happens on Sunday morning. Okay, there's our T equals zero, which is, I love that term, because you can't quite get to it. There are reasons you can't quite get to it. Even theoretically, we can get about as far back as this, what's called Planck time, this 10 to the minus 43rd seconds just after the Big Bang. But what happens in that period right up to the T equals zero, it's like an impenetrable barrier for the mathematics and physics. Okay, so Big Bang, it turns out, Lemaître, Georges Lemaître, called it a primeval atom, said that the universe began from this primeval atom. But that's now passe. That's now an outworn, mistaken part of his theory. His theory was ingenious, but it wasn't right in every respect. Instead of a primeval atom, physicists now talk about a singularity, which basically means their laws don't work at the singularity. When you get to T equals zero, all the laws of physics break down. And yet, that's where they all begin. But they can't get to it. It's really bad. You couldn't ask for a better gift from science than this, really. I mean, this is just like, thank you. This is such a gift to people of faith, this theory. So, all right, here is the evidence for Big Bang Theory. We'll run through it quickly, and feel free to pause and ask if anything's unclear. We've talked about redshifted light briefly. We'll talk a little bit more about each of these in just a moment. But the second is what's called cosmic microwave background radiation. There are a certain amount of certain elements that are predicted by Big Bang Theory, and it turns out that's exactly what's found. I mean, down to the way, way, way down decimal point. And finally, the age of the oldest things in the universe also confirms the Big Bang Theory. All right, so first, the first great clue, redshifted light. You're all familiar with the Doppler effect, even if you don't know the name, because when you hear a siren, a sound is a wave. So when you hear a siren, which is putting out a sound wave on an ambulance, or any kind of siren coming toward you, the wave, see on the side, as the ambulance is approaching the person, you see how the waves are all jammed up together. They get very intense. They get high energy. As they're coming towards you, they're high energy, and they get and as the ambulance moves away from you, the waves are stretched out. They get longer. Now that same effect, that Doppler effect, can be applied to light, because light is also a wave. So here we have a picture. See now, if the light source is moving away, pretend that the sun was moving away from the observer on top, then the red waves will be stretched out. If the light source is approaching the eye, the light will go blue. It'll be shifted to the blue. If you get the light through a spectrum, through a prism and a sound spectrum, and break it into its parts. So all the light of all the galaxies, except the stuff that's very, very close to us, is red shifted. Without exception. So if the real close stuff could be blue shifted or red shifted, anything farther away, it's all red shifted. That was the great Hubble discovery. Okay, you got that? That's the first big technical part. The second great clue. Now, this was the one that proved it beyond any reasonable doubt. There were still some doubters about. They could say, well, yeah, we could have red shift, the whole universe is moving away, but we could still have other explanations for that rather than a Big Bang. But this made Big Bang a virtual scientific certainty, and it remains that way. This happened in 1965. There was near Princeton University out in the country. There used to be, if you remember Bell Laboratory. Do you all remember Bell Labs when there was only like Ma Bell and all that? Well, they put a lot of money into research, and they had a lab out in the country in Princeton, near Princeton, where they had the largest radio telescope in the world at the time. This thing was massive, very big thing. It wasn't just some little thing you had on your desk. It was like a several-story building kind of thing. And there were two men. Arno Penzias and Robert Wilson, who were in charge of this lab, they were listening into all, they had their telescope listening into outer space, trying to pick things up out of space and learn more about the stellar realm. they kept hearing this irritating noise in the radio telescope. It was a kind of a crackling. They kept getting this noise, and no matter where they pointed their telescope, they got the noise. Well, they thought there was some kind of a problem, so they climbed up into this massive thing, and they found what one of them very delicately called white dielectric material, which was pigeon dung. So they got rid of the pigeons. There's some controversy about what they did to those pigeons. I believe those pigeons had a quick demise at that point. But they got rid of the pigeons, they cleaned up the mess, and they went and turned their machine back on, and the noise was still there. So they drive up to Princeton for a physics conference, and there's a couple of physicists up there, and they're working on something very similar. And the four of these guys are talking about their problem, and they said, it turns out that the guys from Princeton said, that's got to be the cosmic microwave background radiation. We've been looking for it. And they had found it by accident. Well, they won the Nobel Prize for this because of what this meant and what it still means. And the meaning is still coming in. Every time somebody sends a satellite up into space, and you say, well, they were doing one, two, three different things, and they were also doing some scientific experiments. They're always doing an experiment on the cosmic microwave background radiation, trying to learn more about that. Okay, so what does it mean? Well, first of all, one more thing about this CMBR. On an old TV set, remember how you would sometimes, especially if you're going between channels, you'd get this white stuff, this snow on the TV? That's the cosmic microwave background. If you're in, sometimes even in the country, when you're driving and you're on radio on, you're getting that crackling. Some of that, at least, is due to this cosmic microwave background radiation. All right, so how does it prove Big Bang? Well, if there was a Big Bang, then there would have been a period after the Big Bang that would have released this radiation, and that had actually been predicted before this was found. It goes a bit like this. In the beginning of the universe, it's so hot. At the very moment, in the first few minutes after the Big Bang, it's so hot, there's not even any atoms that can form. It's just pure chaos. Light and energy. So, you know, actually, when Genesis says that light preceded the sun, and people criticized Genesis 1 for that, it turns out that light really did precede the sun in the original Big Bang. A rather remarkable twist. But for the first 379,000 years, there's what's called a plasma. The whole universe is electrically charged. It's electrically charged because it's so hot that every time an electron wants to join with the nucleus, the radiation, the photons, knock it out. They knock it out of orbit. So the whole universe was like hot, it was thick, it was a cosmic fog. But when things expand, as the universe expands, it cools. That's a basic principle. As it expands, it cools. At 379,000 years, it cooled enough that it, in a weird sense, it froze. It's what they call a phase transition. A typical phase transition is ice, right? At 32 degrees, if the temperature goes to 32, right at 32 degrees, and it does it every time, ice forms. Phase transition. Goes above that, ice starts to melt when it gets hotter than that. But when it cools down to that point, you get that. Well, in a certain sense, the universe froze when it reached right at 379,000 years after the Big Bang at 6 p.m. That's one of my colleagues said. So, but it became cool enough so that the photons, which are light, which were superheated, they were released for the first time. This is a let there be light moment in the universe. So the photons take off and go everywhere. Everywhere in every direction. And that is the origin of the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that's what Penzias and Wilson discovered. Now, fun thing about Arno Penzias. Penzias was born in Germany in the, I think, sometime around 1930, and he was Jewish. So the English, right before World War II actually began, had a program to liberate as many Jewish children as they could, and they were taking them over to England on boats. The last boat out of Germany in 1938 had Arno Penzias on. So we might not have gotten the Big Bang Theory, or at least the confirmation of it, if we'd gone out. This is a fun tangent to tonight's story. Yes?
If the universe is cooling, that implies a non-closed system because the heat energy has to go somewhere. Or does it mean that the heat was absorbed by the rest of the contents of the universe?
I suspect it's the latter, but that's an interesting question that really needs further attention, but probably the latter. But anyway, this becomes part of the astronomical toolbox. So they're always working on redshift, and they're always working on the cosmic microwave background radiation. Okay, let's go on to the third proof for Big Bang. That is the creation of hydrogen, helium, and lithium. Most of the physical matter in the universe is hydrogen. It's actually 74% of the stuff, of the elements, are hydrogen. 24% are helium, second lightest element. Hydrogen is the lightest, then helium. And the third is, there's a small fraction of lithium, and there's 2% of everything else. Now, how did those elements get there? Because you can't have stars without hydrogen and helium. Hydrogen and helium are the fuel that stars burn, and they burn a lot of it, like millions and millions of tons per second. So you got to have massive amounts of hydrogen and massive amounts of helium. How do you get it? Well, the first star can't make its own hydrogen. It can't make its own helium. It's got to get it from somewhere. Turns out it gets it from what's called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. For the first 3 minutes after the Big Bang, it's too hot to form atoms. But after the first 3 minutes, there's already been sufficient cooling, expansion and cooling, not a lot, but just enough, that it hits a sweet spot. So from 3 minutes after Big Bang to 20 minutes after Big Bang, those 17 minutes, the universe is a nuclear cook, and it's creating hydrogen, helium, and lithium. And that's what the theory predicts. Big Bang theory predicts if there was a Big Bang, it was almost infinitely hot. This is what you get after 3 minutes. And in fact, that's what you get everywhere you look in the universe. You see the hydrogen, the helium, and the lithium, and 2% of everything else. Now, a star couldn't have done it. A galaxy couldn't have done it. It had to be the universe itself that produced it. Then another proof of the Big Bang is the age of the oldest thing in the universe. Now, if the universe was eternal, if it was past eternal, if it had existed forever, you would expect to find very old things in it. Now, you do find very old things, but you find very old things up to 12 billion years old, and you don't find anything older than that, which is just about what you'd expect. And so the white dwarfs are is a kind of star that when the star dies, it has a rate of giving off its light, that it gives off its light at a certain rate that is measurable, and then allows the physicists to determine the age of the white dwarf star. The oldest one is right around 12 billion years, which fits about as well as you could ask for with the theory. And then it turns out that from studying the cosmic microwave background radiation, the universe is more accurately right at 13.8 billion years, give or take, to 0.2 billion years. Now, you notice that on my slide, I've got it at 13.7, but like just maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it was updated to 13.8. And that was by satellite study of the CMB. You can call it cosmic microwave background, or you can call it background radiation. Radiation, by the way, sounds ominous, but it's actually very good. We wouldn't be alive without radiation. Radiation just means you've got a source and it's radiating something toward you. You got to have light, you have to have heat, and that's radiation. So the sun is radiation. It's good radiation. Of course, there's bad radiation too, but radiation is just part of the life we live. Okay, so four quick things. Any theory gets tested by new stuff that gets discovered. First, dark matter, dark energy, inflation, and quantum effects. Dark matter turns out that's not an actual picture, because you can't picture dark matter because it's invisible. But it's a fictional representation. Now, the part in the middle there is like the galaxy. Then you think of a galaxy and you think, whoa, they're massive, which they are. They can be hundreds of millions of light years in diameter. But the galaxy is like a little jewel. It's like a diamond. And then the dark matter is huge. And what happened was there was a woman, I think her name was Henrietta Leavitt, somewhere around Washington, D.C., at the conservatory, observatory. And she and her team discovered that there was 10 times the mass. They were picking up 10 times the mass when they were looking out into the universe, 10 times more than the galaxies. And it turns out that this stuff protects the galaxy, because if you didn't have it, the galaxies would tear themselves apart. The stars would fly off. This stuff, which doesn't interact with the galaxies, interacts with it in one sense, just gravitationally, and it holds gravitational attraction to itself. But it's dark. You can't see it, but you can measure its gravitational effect. And by the way, nobody knows exactly what it is. The best theory is probably that it's made of neutrinos, and that theory has gone up and gone down and gone back up again. Dark energy is also a crucial part of this. Dark energy is like anti-gravity in a way. And it turns out that the universe, after cooling and slowing down its expansion at about 9 billion years, it is just recently, in the last 4 billion years, has sped up again. Quite an unexpected discovery. There are surprises. So, you know, when someone tells you with ontological certainty that this is going to happen in the universe, take it with a grain of salt, because no one really thought that the universe was going to re-accelerate after slowing down, but it has. Then this is a weird thing about the theory. That's my term, the time of the timer. The quantum era is from t equals zero into the smallest possible measure of time, 10 to the minus 43rd of 1 second. That's so small, it's almost unimaginable. But it turns out that what's going on inside this almost, it's just so small, why even talk about it? And that was my attitude at first when I started reading this stuff. And I started reading this stuff and I went, oh my gosh, I get it now. There's stuff that goes on during this immediate micro moments after the Big Bang without which we could, you and I wouldn't be here. It starts to look like a setup job. That's where we're going tonight. I'm going to try to show you that this looks and looks and looks like it looks like someone wanted us to be here very badly. Okay, so if you can see from this picture here, like those from the tile floor and blown up, this is the quantum warping that would take place in that first quantum era from t equals 0 to 10 to the minus 43rd seconds. Now, why is that good? Looks rather nasty. It's good because if everything is uniform, gravity can't work on it in the same way. Gravity's going to just, if everything's absolutely uniform, gravity isn't going to pull things together. And you got to pull things together because we want galaxies, we want stars, we want planets. That's how we get here. We got to have that stuff to get in a habitable universe. So the quantum warping appears to be necessary. This is the period of inflation that takes place just after this, in the very, very early micro moments after the Big Bang. Now you see on the left there.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. That picture is false. The picture on the right is fairly accurate. That's how big the universe was at the end of the inflation. But at the beginning of the inflation on the left there, where you see that little very, very small thing, that's billions of times too big. It turns out that the universe was actually billions of times smaller than a single proton. Yeah, it gets mystical. And then you have this, whoosh, and it blows up into about, it's about the size of a grapefruit. Best I could find was an orange, so that'll do. Okay. All right, now these are some alternatives to Big Bang Theory, each of which has different problems. Let's run through them briefly. Steady state was a competitor theory to Big Bang. Almost no one believes in it now because it said the universe was in a steady state where the amount of mass and energy and all that was just steady, and it was just steady. And then when it was discovered that the universe was expanding, then they did an ad hoc thing and said, well, you could just put some more energy into it somehow. It's really almost a dead theory now. The multiverse theory is important. This is the current best competitor to the Big Bang Theory. Multiverse means many, many, many universes, maybe an infinite number of universes. Now, all the scientists agree that are worthy of the name that there was a Big Bang. But what many of them are trying to do, because the Big Bang looks so friendly to Genesis, they're trying to get beyond it. And they just don't want to be boxed in this one universe. So they want to say, well, there could be universes of universes, multiple universes, and that's what they call the multiverse. The problem is there is zero evidence for a multiverse, none, absolutely none. And it may not even be possible to get evidence. No one currently even has a plan for how to get evidence that if there was such a thing. All we know is that the universe began 13.8 billion years ago. Then there's a thing called the bouncing universe or the oscillating universe where you have a Big Bang and then gravity takes everything back and sucks it back in. Gravity pulls things back together. But the problem with this is that every time gravity did that, there would be frictional, there'd be an increase in friction, an increase in entropy, and you get fewer and fewer stars. And once again, there's absolutely no evidence of any bounce. So it's never happened. You could make the math work with this. String theory had great promise, and people promised everything this side of the moon, but over the last 30 years, it just hasn't produced. So it's been, the math in string theory is so hard that it has some promise because it's a multi-dimensional theory. It says there's as many as 11 dimensions, not just the three dimensions we know plus time. There's seven others. So speculation is fine. Scientists always speculate. But then they need to test their theory. And then they confirm or reject it. Now, Big Bang Theory went through the test. It was first it was speculation, then it was tested, both in terms of the redshift of all the galaxies, then also of the cosmic microwave background radiation, and then Einstein's theory was also tested. And Einstein came up with his theory in 1916, and his theory said that basically it's a theory of gravity. It said when light comes around, when light is going around or hitting a big body, that it'll go around it and it'll be bent in a certain way. So in 1919, Arthur Eddington planned an exhibition to Africa to try to confirm the theory. And there was an eclipse where the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a very distant star lined up. And they did very accurate measurements, and they got exactly what Einstein's theory predicted. So that was how it's confirmed. Now, I'm telling you all this not just because Einstein's theory is confirmed and Big Bang theory is confirmed, but because none of the other competitor theories have been confirmed. They are pure speculation. Some people even question whether or not they're science. So right now, science is the best friend we could have for if you want a universe with a beginning. That's the point here. Big Bang provides a scientific beginning, and it's deeply, deeply theological. Well, okay, folks, I think you've been, this is heavy lifting. I think we should take a break and we should eat some snacks. When you come back, we'll talk about any questions you might have, but also I want to talk to you about what's called fine-tuning, which gets very, very exciting and also looks wonderful from the point of view if you believe God created the universe. So let's take a short break.